The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. Today, Mike Sensei and I will be offering our Teisho, our Dharma talk, and already we've heard the prequel, the story itself, and the sequel of our koan that we selected for this sesshin. The sesshin that is the Rohatsu sesshin, the sesshin that celebrates one of our Zen holidays, the moment that Shakyamuni Buddha, our ancestor, woke up to reality, and then began his teaching career, which has come down all the way to this moment, at this very moment, this very breath that we're breathing in or breathing out, the teachings reverberating through the years. And I wanted to tell you why we chose this koan. Of course, it's such a rich koan, and as you've been hearing with all of the different stories connected to these characters, especially Daishan, who went through so much in his life, as all of us do, and the ups and downs of the spiritual path, the awakenings and the falling apart again, and awakening and falling apart. This is how I understand the path. It's not a moment where a finger snaps, a star appears in the morning sky, and everything is clear and wonderful from then on, and we can give up our practice because we're all set. Sometimes the popular literature on Zen seems to point in that direction, but any of us who live a Zen life know that that's not true. Even when we idealize teachers of the past, teachers of the present, who seem to have it all together because of something that happened to them that they might call awakening, we know that this isn't what the Zen life is actually about. And so we see Daishan, who starts out as an arrogant scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and then he meets the old woman in the tea shop and neglects to understand her teaching, and then goes to Lung Tan, and the koan begins with he talks with Lung Tan, he questions him far into the night. And then he has his little adventures with Lung Tan, with the darkness and the candle and the darkness again, the praise and the burning of the notes. And then, as Reverend Paul told us last night, many, many years later, actually the story that happens shortly before Daishan's death as an old man, an old teacher, his arrogance is all worn away, and he comes to find what we say in that particular koan, a different koan, the last word of Zen. So the last word of Zen is right here in the falling snow, right here in Worcester, in the Worcester Hills. We're getting a big snowstorm today, and the snow just keeps falling, which is sometimes what it does. Later, it will stop falling and people will be plowing and shoveling. But right now, inside this little hermitage where David and I have taken up residence during this sesshin, where Corwin is visiting and helping out with the sutra service that we just finished, it's just snowing. Nothing more than that. And I want to look into, very particularly today, the little moment of that candle blowing out and how it relates to the Buddha's awakening. and how it relates to our own experience as human beings, moving one step in front of the other into our lives, striding ahead, not knowing what is in front of us. I've had many conversations with people over this period of time, this strange year of 2020, when it just seems like a pileup of stuff. But really, if anybody was paying attention, it doesn't have to have been so surprising. Biologists and immunologists have known for years that a pandemic like this was coming, although they didn't know the details of it. Anyone who studied American history knows that the upswelling of racial violence is not new. All the other ways that we are unable to meet other people as fellow human beings, nothing new. The politics of this country seems so outrageous, but nothing new. It's happened again and again and again. This is maybe the only thing that's a little different, but again, people could have predicted it, is the power of the internet in our lives. But I think people were looking at that too 10, 20 years ago, and climate change predictions have been happening also for decades. Why are we so surprised by this year? Because we think we know what's happening. We hide inside of our own delusions and trust them more than we trust the reality of our own senses. And this, more than anything, is what Zen practice is about. Not trusting our delusions, but trusting the evidence of our senses, our sensory perceptions. The Buddha sat all night long, in some traditions longer than that, while he engaged with all of the things that we engage with, all of the mind games that we play, coming up as judgment and self-criticism, coming up as fear, as desire, as anger, as sadness, as moments of being blissed out, all of it, passing and passing and passing. And the teaching of that night, which we celebrate as December 7th, according to a modern calendar, but who knows when it was. That night, that dark night, that night of facing the reality of our suffering, this is what happens to all of us all the time. If we're really honest, it's hard to be a human being. And if we open up to the suffering of not only ourselves, but the whole world, it's heartbreaking to be a human being. This is why the Bodhisattva of compassion has a broken heart as she looks down and sees the suffering of the world. This is not a problem to have a broken heart. And it's not a problem to feel alone in the darkness. And when the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, our historical ancestor who lived 2,600 years ago, when he survived that night and looked up and in the darkness, in the utter darkness, he saw a star, the morning star. And just that little tiny point of light in the dark sky of dawn, before the sun had even begun to send up any of its rays, something shifted inside him. Something shifted inside his heart mind, and he understood something about the way things are. This is the same awakening that we all have on this Zen path, and before we even hear about Zen, and even if we abandon it. This is what it means to be a human being. The most amazing capacity, as Alan pointed out last night, we as human beings get to know this. And there is Daishan, one piece of the prequel that didn't get mentioned because it's not part of Wu Men's commentary. But when Deshan left the old tea woman and rushed to find Lung Tang, he didn't treat Lung Tan with respect. When he met him, he insulted him. He made a joke about his name. And Lung Tan just met him in that moment with complete presence and invited him to sit down in his rooms. And then the long night of Deshan began. And in that long night of questioning and opening, and Lung Tan offering him these teachings, which we are offering to you and which you have decided to receive because you've all engaged in this Zen path, and here you are at a sesshin. An unusual thing to do with one's time, I have to say. He looked outside when he was ready to go. Lung Tan actually said, maybe this is enough. We've talked a long time. Why don't you go and lay your head down and get some sleep? And Deshan looked out of the room and there was only darkness. Just like the darkness that the Buddha experienced in his long night. Just like the darkness that so many of us experience on a regular basis. Who here hasn't had their heart broken? Who here doesn't struggle with something? Zen will not save us from suffering. Zen will allow us to have a new relationship to our suffering. When we fall down the rabbit hole, we think that we should scramble as hard as we can to get back to the surface. But the invitation is to feel that falling, feel the darkness, open to the darkness. In that darkness, something will come along, like Lung Tan, like the morning star, here. Here's a little point of light for you, a teaching, a pointer, a direction. Look, look, listen, listen, here it is, right here. And you can't keep it. You can't hold on to it because it is temporary like everything else. So he lights a paper candle, old Lung Tan, and he hands it to this new ornery student. And we can only imagine, Deshan, you imagine yourself in that position. As Pierce shared with us, the ancient koan of what happens, where is Goofy when the light goes out? He's in the darkness. And this is what happens with Lung Tan and Deshan. Lung Tan blows out the candle. And it's darkness again. And in that moment, Deshan, like Shakyamuni Buddha, has something turn inside him. These moments are described as a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. Sometimes they're very tiny and they pass by and we don't even notice them. But Zen contextualizes them. So in Zen practice, we get to have a reflective moment with this. And sometimes we have someone who's there with us, who points it out in the beautiful translation that David read yesterday from David Hinton of this koan, a modern poet and practitioner. Lung Tan asks him, you just saw the inner pattern of the way. You just saw the inner pattern of the way. Tell me about this. And this is what we see. We see the inner pattern of the way. We see the way things are, the way they actually are. Not the way we would like them to be or the way they hope they are, that we are living our life. We see here in the Worcester Hills, the snow falling from the sky. We feel what we feel. We hear what we hear. This is it. Just before I hand this talk over to Mike to see what he's going to do with it, I want to just share with you a couple of lines from a poem that came into my inbox yesterday after David and Bob's beautiful talk. I checked my email because it's just a reflex, and you all know about that. We've been talking about it. I subscribe to a poetry listserv that every once in a while sends forth a poem. It's a spiritual poetry listserv. And this one was a poem I'd never heard before from Mary Oliver. And it's a little bit long, so just I'll read you the first few lines and the last few lines. She says, "What is there beyond knowing that keeps calling to me? What is there beyond knowing that keeps calling to me? I can't turn in any direction, but I know it's there." And she ends her poem by saying, "But mostly, I just stand in the dark field, in the middle of the world, breathing in and out. Mostly, I just stand in the dark field, in the middle of the world, breathing in and out." This is not something that only Zen practitioners know. This is something that all human beings are capable of perceiving. If we sit still long enough in the darkness, the light will come, and then it will go. So over to Mike, who will take us in perhaps a new direction, or maybe a deepening of this direction.
Thank you, Melissa. I just love this talk so far, and I'm ready to ruin it for you. But so it's such an exquisite exploration of the dark. And often what practice feels like for us is this exploration of the dark. Taishan bravely names what he is experiencing in a moment. Perhaps we don't know, but this person of great knowledge finally seems vulnerable in a moment when he says, "It is dark outside." This really is a moment of courage when we name what we are seeing. So often we turn away, we run away, and are controlled by what we don't want to experience as we keep running away from it. So it is a courageous thing that he does that evening, when in that moment of vulnerability, simply acknowledges, "It's dark outside. I can't see. I can't see what I've been looking for my whole life. Help me." The next morning, Lungtan praises him for that courage. Sometimes it's interesting to take a koan as if it were sincere. What a brave fellow. And Taishan responds even though you have learned all the secrets of the world. Of course, he's speaking of himself, right? Even though I felt I had learned all the secrets of the world in all of my study, it is like letting a single drop of water fall into an enormous valley. Everything that I knew is like a drop of water in an enormous valley. So small compared to that which is calling beyond what I know. As Melissa so eloquently referred to Mary Oliver's poem. We can see this as a moment of humility for Deshaun. Imagine all of your scholarship, which you're so attached to. Imagine saying, my God, it didn't have the value that I thought it had. Imagine the sincerity of that moment. Now, yes, it can seem a bit much to burn the notes, right? But what if we take that as an act, a sincere expression of a real revelation that he has had? My knowledge did not mean all I'd thought it meant. I am humbled. In that same poem that Melissa discussed, she writes, what I know I could put into a pack as if it were bread and cheese and carry it on one shoulder. Important and honorable, but so small. While everything else continues unexplained and unexplainable. Imagine if Deshaun had had that attitude when he stood before the tea woman. Imagine if each of us might have that attitude of openness and curiosity with everyone we meet. But so often, due to our arrogance or unconscious sexism, racism, classism, we aren't open to the teachings that are available to us. We are lost in what we think we already know. What is it to extend, to open ourselves beyond what we already know? The Blue Cliff Record, case 89. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, how does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes? And Dao Wu said, it is just like a person in the middle of the night reaching in search of a pillow. In the middle of the night, in the middle of our not knowing, there is possibility. The sense is probing. The receptivity of touch, of sound, as we seek. And it is this great curiosity, this great looking that we celebrate in the Zen tradition. A kind of humility. Many of us know the poem by Wendell Berry, To Know the Dark. To go in the dark with a light is to know the light. To know the dark. Go without sight. And find that the dark too blooms and sings and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings. Thank you, everyone.
So we'll move into our Dharma dialogue, and Mike and I will reflect your comments and questions back. And we'll start with Zeph.
Hi. I had a lot of fun during this Dharma talk because I wasn't able to go to yesterday's Dharma talk. So between the sequels and prequels, I was completely in the dark. And Mike said it was over the top to burn the notes. The first thing I said was, oh my gosh, she burned the notes. And then the second thing I said was, what notes? So it was a lot of fun, and thank you.
I knew that you and Ray had both missed the talk yesterday, and I had this thought, should we just go over the whole thing again? But clearly Mike and I were on the same wavelength. We had more important things to say. And you can always listen to those talks online on the podcast or wherever they're going to appear. But yeah, how beautiful, Zeph, to be in the dark about the story. So somebody's telling a story about something that's really intense. I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know what happened. But you can just join in. Feel what you're feeling. Have fun. That's great. I love that. Yeah. Thank you. Ray, also in the dark.
Yeah, I did look up the koan this morning, and I love the blowing out of the light as an image of awakening for me. And I've begun to grasp the difference between understanding and experiencing. That understanding is, concession to the discursive mind. So I've loved your talk and sort of translated when you said see or to know as not an activity of the intellect, which my mind wants to continuously understand, but an activity of experiencing, to know from kind of a place beyond understanding and the dark so much, but you've explained so beautifully, cannot be understood. It can only be experienced, at least for me. And sort of like that opens up things up for me of not having to understand, but to experience it.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Right. I was like the word that David uses frequently, the invitation. Melissa too, sometimes they use this word invitation. This invitation to experience, yes, our knowledge. It doesn't say the knowledge was a drop of poison, that's dropped into the forest. It says it's a drop of water. There's something very nourishing in that, right? So not to be excluded, but so much more, right? So much more available. That you're talking about, that we can experience directly. Melissa talks about this invitation to our senses, right? Come back to our senses. That phrase, very meaningful, to come back to our senses, to awaken to this sensory world we read in one chant. Neither senses nor the world, both senses and the world, this non-dualistic experience of things just as they are. Moment after moment, I can use the word, oh, I'm sad, and think I know what I mean. But I really don't. I mean, it's a pointer towards some cloud, some amorphous cloud of experiences and fluid thoughts and shape-shifting presences and energies that we can go dark and we can know it in a different way. Thank you, Ren.
And I just, you know, by the way, Mike and I did not discuss the Mary Oliver poem ahead of time. We both encountered it serendipitously. That blew me away when you started quoting from it, Mike. But later on, that beautiful little, you know, what I know I could put into a pack as if it were bread and cheese and carry it on one shoulder. And then she says, important and honorable, but so small. I think this is just what Deshan says about that drop of water. It's important and honorable, but it's so small. So what a sweet thing. It just, yeah. So Betty, you had your hand up before, but I see you put it down. Do you still want to offer a comment or a question?
Yeah, it felt a little off topic maybe, but I'll try anyway. So I felt a little distracted. I did appreciate the talks today and yesterday as well, but I was distracted by the snow. And because when I first moved here about 6 years ago, we had that awful winter where we had tons and tons of snow. And I just moved here and we had that snow and I started to develop ice dams like everybody did. And my living room walls started falling down. So every time we have snow, I'm like in like, oh, I don't want to have snow. I've actually come, what I do now is I go out and I rake the roof. Every time it snows, I go out and I won't miss raking the roof because I'm so afraid to have that happen again. We haven't had that much snow. I'm still going to go out and rake the roof. Because it took until, I think we had the snow in February and I didn't get my walls back up until April or May because it was so hard to get construction people and everybody's house needed to be fixed. So it was a mess. It was just terrible.
You know, Betty, you said you're taking it in a different direction, but I'm not sure that's true. Because of time limitations, I didn't say all the things that I was thinking of saying in the talk, but one of the things was, this is my experience, not yours, that when I saw that it was going to snow today, I had a very negative reaction to it, you know, because I go through all the things about shoveling and plowing and ice dams and oh my God, what's going to happen? And I noticed this morning for myself, there was a moment that shifted. So these were all, you know, the thoughts, the memories, the traumas of past storms, right? And then suddenly I just saw that snow falling down. You know, it just went. So the teaching is that we don't want to ignore these narratives, these painful narratives. We don't want to dismiss them and say, just look at the snow, God damn it, it's so beautiful. Because it doesn't feel beautiful if those narratives are in the way of experiencing it. So the teaching is that you experience these narratives as narratives. Mm-hmm. That's it. And then just see where it leads. That was the work I was doing this morning with my own little pea brain.
Yeah. Well, I would prefer some late fluffy snow.
Yeah. Well, but again, and there's what we were talking about yesterday, all our preferences.
Right.
This is what is. Ice dams, maybe. Raking the roof. I'll have that image in my head forever. Thank you. Okay. I'm glad I called on you. Marla.
I would like to give credit to being Zen and enlightened, but I think I'm actually just kind of resigned for over the last couple of weeks. I tend to have a mind that gets really wrapped up in my job and my hobbies and my writing classes, and I had been feeling like I was going 100 miles an hour for a long time, and then part of that was like finishing my sewing and getting it to the UPS store, and then I got food poisoning right before the right before the session, and I thought, oh no, but I've gotten through a day and a half of it just fine, and just slept well last night, and we had a plumbing emergency this morning, so that was human life. But instead of going back to the 100 miles an hour, it was just like, oh shoot. And it didn't turn out to be catastrophic, so it's dealt with. And I want to believe that sitting Zazen and really being in community for all of yesterday and Thursday night, helped to take that from, why does this always happen when I'm the only person at home? And, ew, what's that under the sink? To like, whatever. Like, I'll get back to the retreat. Oh, whatever. And human life can be a lot worse, but sometimes when you're in the middle of a session and there's a bad smell coming from under your sink and there's goop, you know, that seems unpleasant for a moment. And I would really like I said, I'd like this to be enlightenment. I think it's some kind of surrender and resignation and maybe peacefulness, the mid-session peacefulness. That's good enough. Maybe like, where are you when you're up to your wrist in goop, cleaning it? You're in goop.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. I'm so glad I got back in time for your Dharma talk and most of the sutra service.
Marla, there's two things that, I notice in your comment, that I want to appreciate. One is, the way that, our suffering can be a gift. We don't always look at it that way. Of course it doesn't feel like that, as it shows up. But you know, the way that I'm hearing you speak about, food poisoning is that it was a gift to you, that it is something that, right? That kind of like, it made you slow down. It made you, it brought something forth, from you, you know, and in the Noble Truths, we have the Four Noble Truths, and the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. And you know, that is lifelong, that this is part of what we experience, and how we meet it is how it is transformed. And sometimes that meeting is a bowing down, you know, we bow every, sutra service, we bow, this possibility of meeting things just as they are. And that sense of surrender that you're talking about, I think is so important. You know, and the other thing is we have these, you know, these grandiose terms that we use in Zen, enlightenment, awakening. Of course they are pointing to life, to life as it is. And we can turn that into something that we know. Right. Oh, I know what enlightenment is. I know what awakening is. And of course, then we're lost, aren't we? That is precisely the teaching. So if you think you don't know what enlightenment is, you're on the right track.
Thank you. Alan.
So I wanted to follow up on Mike's hint about the bonfire that Deshaun makes, but it tickles me partly because I'm a scholar some of the time and I have all kinds of commentaries and writings that I could, you know, happily get rid of. But, and in fact, when I do get rid of files, it always feels like such a relief at this age. I don't want them around anymore. But if I were to pile them all up at BC, at Boston College outside of Stokes Hall and light them on fire, people would think, who does this guy think he is? You know, why can't he just dump them in the recycling?
Yeah, right.
You know, and in ancient China, you know, they may have been thinking, we could really have used all that paper in the latrine, you know, and what a waste. And so, what came to me though is that, Longtan holds out a little paper candle and lights it and blows it out. And then Deshaun makes this big bonfire of paper. Should he have blown that out?
Well, just taking aside the cleverness of the final question. I think the real issue here, Alan, is that you're making a connection between the paper candle and the bonfire, right? Which is important, and also the arrogance. You know, that he just because he was arrogant, and then he has this wonderful opening when the candle gets blown out, doesn't mean he stops being arrogant. You know, the all of us have what, you know, really seriously, self-valued personality traits that we cling to because that's the only thing we know about who we are. There's no way, to get through that. And I love Daishan's story because it so clearly demonstrates that, you know, the very next koan where he appears in as a character is, he's just arrogant again. He comes in to visit another teacher and marches around the Zendo going the opposite direction from what you're supposed to do in Zendo etiquette. And there's a little line in that koan where he leaves and then he comes back and then he leaves again. The teacher finally says, "Where'd that guy go? That new arrival," he calls him. "Where'd that new arrival go?" And there's a comment from Robert Aitken, "New arrival indeed." You know, so we're always scratching the surface. And just like in what I said to Betty, the point of the practice is not to burn everything up, right? Because obviously we can't. But the point of the practice is to use the light to see what we can see. And then when we go back into the darkness again to just like in the Wendell Berry poem, which was also in my notes, Mike, we should just give up and be one person. I don't know. That's crazy. The quality of engaging with whatever is here, right? The quality of owning his own arrogance, which starts to happen in his life. Who knows? Maybe it never really wore off in spite of the sequel that we heard about last night from Reverend Paul. Maybe it was always there right up until the last moment. That's okay, because he was able to live through that. Maybe the fear of the ice dams will always be with some of us. But can we live with that? That's what Zen asks. That's the real question.
Yeah, and I would just add that, I mean, it's a clear kind of what we might, I think, might describe as an overcorrection. This thing of, I'm going to get rid of this thing that is part of me. And that's never the teaching, right? It's to meet who we are one moment after another. You know, Daishan, he's such an amazing character through all these koans. And when he's walking in the opposite direction and challenging and all these things, this too is him just showing up so completely as himself. You know, I'm in the world of emptiness. See, look at me. And in a way, absurd, but in a way also really quite profound, you know, quite a profound thing going on there. So, you know, in the thing that we're most ashamed of, sometimes the seed of something very valuable.
Thank you, Al. Let's move on to Pierce.
Thank you both for these wonderfully interlocking talks. And I found that as I was listening, especially to Melissa's, I found that I was giving my assent to it. I was saying to myself, yeah, this is true. But I also noticed that there's another voice that is saying, what am I going to take away? Or how am I going to get a handle on this? And I think the two, I love the way the two poets, complement each other. And, Mary Oliver says, there's something beyond knowing. It's funny that she then says, I know it's there.
Yeah.
I think she kind of slipped up there. I also love the Wendell Berry, for saying, you know, don't take a light into the darkness. And what I see in the two poems is the thing that I'm doing. You know, I'm looking for a handle. I'm looking for a shovel to dig with. I'm looking for a flashlight so that I will shine it in there and the light will go on. And that's a kind of repudiation of the darkness. And I'm just going to quote another secular poet. Yeats, at the end of his life, said, "I don't think that human beings can know truth, but they can embody it." Mm. And I remember how disappointed I was as a young person when I read this, you know, because I thought, he's been searching all his life and this is all he can come up with. But now I have a different attitude. And I think you guys are expressing that attitude also. So thanks. Yeah. This was great.
Oh, thank you, Pierce. Well, you know, there's Wu Men, our buddy Wu Men, who collected this koan, also has a poem like that, like Yeats's, where he says, Zen students don't know the truth. They only know their experience up until now. Right. And so this knowing, not knowing, this light going on, the light going off, you know, the morning star comes and the dawn breaks and but then nighttime comes again over and over and over. And I want to just put in a plug for the value of the flashlight. Right. Because it's not about just being in the dark all the time. There are moments of illumination. There really are insights that arise. We get to know ourselves better and better and better. David's teacher used to call that the cringe practice. You know, we get to know ourselves better and better. It's like, oh God, but it's part of the process. You know, so illuminating these things, it's also part of it. It's just we don't want to cling to either.
Yeah, we can fetishize the not knowing.
Yeah. Esther.
So I want to thank every single Dharma teacher in the hall. So many impressions. You know. And something is resonating with me from what Ray said. And it's about the, you know, maybe when darkness arises and we find ourselves in these fields of dark, maybe there's a great illumination in that too. And I'm reminded of being in my summer house trying to go to the bathroom in the night and it's pitch black and how I draw on other senses and feel my way, try to walk into the doorway, you know, yelling because I hurt my foot, waking up my spouse. But just, you know, the way that we find another way of sensing into what's here, what's going on and something else becomes possible when there's not that light. And, you know, curious, what if when darkness arises, we could appreciate it? Oh, a little lost here, maybe completely lost, but if we could recognize it as an awakening in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. You know, I was thinking of when I was reflecting on this koan before, I was thinking of a baby lying, you know, as I was thinking of that koan, of a baby lying in a crib, kind of reaching out, reminds me of Boober, you know, reaching out for like an animal, a stuffed animal, and not knowing what it will feel like. But to become one with that experience, the sensory experience, to know in a fully, not as an objectified thing of within the mind, but as a full engagement with that animal, you know, to touch, to really touch. That's sort of the image that came to mind. And I thought of, you know, so often I think maybe many of us think back on childhood and you think, God, do you remember your first snow, what that was like? And we wonder, why isn't it like that for me now? Well, you know, I think that there's possibility here, right? To turn toward things as they are and realize, actually, I've never experienced this before.
Exactly. Well, and I think too, this is what Wendell Berry's pointing to in the poem, To Know the Dark, right? So it really is, what's here? What's here? I don't know. I just flashed on one of my first jobs right out of college was being the assistant to a woman who was blind. And she, one of the things she taught me a lot, but one of the things she taught me was how to walk in the dark, because she walked in the dark all the time. And I still use that technique she taught me, but it's very related to what both Esther and Mike are talking about here, and what Wendell Berry is talking about and what Ray was talking about. You take one arm and protect your body. And with the other arm, you slowly sweep back and forth. And then you take one little step and another little step and another little. This was her whole life of walking, because she, unless she was home where she knew where everything was, she had to do this. And so I still do it in the dark when I get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, or get up to adjust my pillow or whatever it is. And it has this, I love it because there's a protecting and a sweeping and a moving forward. And this is maybe how we do this practice. So let's move to Eddie.
Oh, thanks, Melissa and Mike. So I'm not too sure if this relates to the koan, but I think it relates to a lot of the dialogue. And my mind can be a very dangerous place. I can come up with these scenarios that are never, ever going to happen. They may have happened before, but, you know, I'm worried about something happening again. And so that's one thing. And the other thing is that we're talking about this walking around in the dark. Well, we have other senses that someone would talk about, but I've lost a lot of my hearing in as I get older. And it was a sudden loss. So I went to this neuroaudiologist to find out what was going on. So one of the tests he had me do was to stand up in front of him and close my eyes and march in place. So, you know, I'm marching and I'm marching. And I'm starting to giggle. I'm saying, how long is he going to make me do this for? You know, this is, and my partner was in the room also. And then he said, okay, open your eyes. And when I opened my eyes, I was facing this way. I had no idea that I was turning. So your ears, your hearing, and all of it is synchronized to us humans. Mm-hmm. But, you know, today I was watching my birds out in the bird feeder. Pouring rain. It's not snowing here in Norwood yet. But they're not worried about the rain, the snow, and, you know, they're just doing what they got to do. And it's like, oh boy, I'm so envious of wildlife. My cat, he's been either sitting beside me or he's been sitting in the corner in the next room. So evidently one of the field mice that hasn't been trained properly got into the house because they usually don't come in because they could smell the cat. But there must be something because he's just laying there waiting and waiting. And he'll be there for hours and hours and hours, and I'll have to watch where I'm stepping tomorrow morning when I wake up. So,
Eddie, the attentiveness, right, of that cat waiting, you know, what a beautiful model, in a way for practice, right? Mm-hmm. And of course the power of the mind to create alternate realities, is often what we are paying attention to. So just realizing that is part of what we watch. And, you know, I loved how Melissa put it before, you know, noticing that it is these are mental formations, right? We don't need to get rid of them. Sometimes they're drops of water. Sometimes they're quite nourishing. And the Dharma in their own way. But they are just mental formations too, right? And when we see that, there's some liberative quality. Yeah. Thank you.
And yeah, I think we have time for one last word from Brad, the last word of Zen.
This might be un-Zen or not Zen. Yesterday and today, I've been having trouble keeping up with the koan. And it seems very complex, and this conversation does too. And for some reason, I'm more drawn to the contrast between Melissa and Mike's voices, maybe male and female. And my screen is so colorful, like a quilt. It's so different, like different patches. I guess I'm content with that. I usually like to be more astute, but I'm sitting here kind of dumbfounded and mildly entertained.
Dumbfounded and mildly entertained. I think that is a great description of the path of Zen. So maybe let's stop there. Thank you so much, Brad. Stay dumbfounded and mildly entertained. May we all be that. And we'll just sit for just a moment in Zazen, and then we'll hear our instructions we'll hear a bell, and then we'll hear our instructions.